The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Are you looking for more customers for your business? Are you facing new competitors, not just across town, but across the country? How about across borders? How about worldwide? Welcome to Global Reach with your host, Tay Revez. As new technology makes it easier to connect with your customers, it also makes it easier for international competitors to reach them. Our program will help you stay competitive in a tough marketplace. Now, here's your host, Tay Revez.
Welcome to Global Reach, everyone. This is a show that helps your business find opportunities, manage risks, and develop strategies for winning in the global marketplace. This week we ask a multi-billion dollar or multi-billion euro, multi-billion yen question. In the world of payments, is the balance of power shifting from banks to retailers? Who, if anyone, owns the customer? Well, my guest this week, Matt Sinister, he's the Managing Director of Oriama Consulting Group UK. He's put a lot of thought into this question. He advises a lot of financial services companies, and we're going to have a wide-ranging discussion on why this matters to your business, to your business's purchasing power, not to mention to your personal shopping experience. Hint, think innovation, think customer loyalty, brand trust, think industry lobbying power in Europe, the U.S., and Australia. It's going to be a really interesting show. Welcome to Global Reach, Matt. And we really appreciate your calling in from London at night to do the show.
No problem. It's either that or going to do the washing up at home. So
we're more fun. So let me tell the audience a little bit more about you. As I mentioned, Matt heads up the UK office of the Oriama Consulting Group. He's responsible for growing the company's footprints in Europe, and he's had almost 20 years of experience with financial services, where he's built up the reputation as an outstanding strategist who is able to use his operational sales, marketing, distribution, product, P&L skills to develop and implement strategy that deliver high-value return. Now, that can also give us some hints for those of us who are not in the financial services industry as well. Matt's been responsible for marketing and product management at the Alliance and Leicester Commercial Bank, VP of Marketing at Affinion, and variously managing director of a Barclaycard, head of value-added services at Barclaycard business. He's got an honors BA from the Anglia Ruskin University and is a member of the Institute of Direct Marketing. So he's got a lot of value for us this week. It's going to be a good show. Matt, set the scene for us. When we talk about the balance of power between banks and retailers in terms of payment transaction, what are we talking about, and why does this matter to the audience?
Well, let me take you back 5 years, and obviously the unprecedented changes that we've seen in the global economic markets. Banks have been hit from all sides, their use of capital, the way they've managed products, their customer servicing, and to be honest, they've retrenched. They've wound themselves back in, and they've tried to focus on some of the things that they do well in their core markets. At the same time, retailers have decided that actually they need to retain consumer spend, particularly in everyday spending categories, gasoline, shopping. I'd even go to say an essential item these days is a mobile phone bill and mobile phone accessories. So they've had to continue to market and communicate and win customers through this period over the last 5 years, whereas the banks have had so much pressure, they've started to step back. My hypothesis and the things we're discussing tonight is I think what that has done is it's allowed a shift of balance and power in the world of payments. Now, the world of payments can be something, as you said, in terms of as simple as your own use of your own credit card or your business card to the way that the way you shop online, or the way that you shop in store, or indeed to just generally how you collect an invoice your customers around the world and across borders. So this shift of power will hit everybody in terms of both risks and opportunities as it evolves and it continues to evolve.
Okay. Let's look at, as we talk about it impacts us, what about the impact of this changing balance of power on rewards, customer loyalty, consumer loyalty? As we said, most of us have personal reward cards. Many of us have business credit or debit cards with rewards. And there's a whole range of cards. What's happening with customer loyalty? Who owns the customer? Really, that's central. Who has the best chance to get that customer loyalty?
That's a great question. I'm actually going to ask you a question first in return before I answer that. Is when you go out and shop, which card do you pull out first of your wallet?
My debit card.
Your debit card. That's what most people do for low-value, everyday spend. In terms of a credit card, almost universally, the first card that's pulled out of a wallet is a card that has rewards on it. You want to be rewarded for your spend. And I think certainly in the U.S., I think it's 80% of all credit card holders hold a rewards card, and 90% of the market pull out their rewards card first of all. And it doesn't matter who it's from. Consumers want to be rewarded. And that's really important in terms of brand loyalty. It doesn't matter whether that card is issued by Citi or Standard Chartered or JCB. It's the card that has the best rewards. Now, who provides those rewards is the real question. And that's the point. This is exactly the battleground we're talking about. People don't care whether it's Citi or whether it's Walmart or whether it's Amazon. I want to be rewarded for my loyalty. And that is where I think that the retailers are beginning to gain the upper hand in terms of understanding what those consumers want and the types of rewards that will appeal to them most.
Why do the retailers have the edge?
That's also a great question, and I think there's a couple of answers here. Firstly, they see more data in terms of spend than the banks do. So they can actually construct offers and reward mechanisms that are probably more appropriate for your own spend. So that they see a bit more data. I think the other really important thing is just in terms of the amount of value they can throw at this. If you walked into a store and said, I'd like that television, it's $1,000 or the equivalent in sterling or yen, but I'll only take it if you knock $10 off. Any retailer is out there to win your business. Of course they're going to give it to you. When a bank funds a rewards program, there might be a 1% cash back on that $1,000 ticket, which is, again, a $10 cash back. But you might not be even in that category that qualifies. You might have already hit your limit that month. So if I was a retailer and I wanted to aggressively discount, I can. And 5, 10% off goods are very often seen even in non-sale days. On sale days, you can see items that are 40% below their face value. So the retailer knows that they can give away more value because ultimately what they're trying to do is to increase footfall and increase the spend in their store. There's far more margin in that spend than there is than can be afforded by the banks who fund the rewards programs.
And if you've got that retailer's store card, whether it's a proprietary store card or it's a co-branded with a Visa or MasterCard store card, they have your specific spend pattern in the store, and they can really tailor the offers to you.
Absolutely, and that can happen real time, and this is some of the technology and the innovation. You can be walking around that store now, and particularly if we're talking around mobile wallets, where you can be walking around and those offers can be geolocation or store-based, and they're actually targeting you while you're in the store, looking at your shopping patterns, where you are, which department you're walking through. And the retailer sees that in real time, and they can respond. Unfortunately, the banks can't. They're one step removed from that shopping experience and that buying experience.
Now, the other party that gets a lot of customer spend data is the credit card company, is the MasterCard, the Visa, the American Express. And I know Visa at least had a really powerful consumer spend tracking. They've made the big data analysis a specialty, particularly with their signature card.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a trend I think we're seeing across lots of different markets and lots of different industries. And we're stepping into the realm of what is commonly known as big data. It's been around in banking for many years in terms of trying to build spending patterns and patterns of your own personal risk before people lend to you. I think, again, the retailers historically have been better at targeting those offers because they've just been doing it longer. I think what the schemes, Visa, MasterCard, American Express, Diners Club, all do is collect data. I think certainly they're trying to harness that data, but the challenge that they're finding is when they want sell it back to retailers, the retailers are, why are you selling us back our own data? We're already paying you for this. So it's being collected, it's being analyzed, but actually is it yet being used would be my challenge.
You know, we've got a listener on hold with a question. Are you ready to take one? We've got 3 minutes of a break. Can we put the caller on, please?
Yes, this is David True. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. David, welcome to Global Reach. Thanks for calling in. What's your question for Matt?
Great conversation. Well, there's 2 points. One, just wanted to elaborate on a good point he made earlier. The other point related to data is that the merchants have product-level data, which the payment schemes do not see. The payment schemes know that you bought a bunch of stuff for a certain dollar amount or value at a merchant, but they don't know what you bought. That is only held by the merchants, except in rare exceptions. The other case, the question I want to bring up is rewards are very, very powerful. However, I'm wondering what your guest's opinion is of the chances of merchants disrupting or bypassing the payment networks. Because over the past several years, the cost of accepting payments has been increased by the dominant networks, the dominant schemes, Visa and MasterCard, with the justification that it's for a rewards program. However, the merchants are, wait, you're creating a rewards program and charging me for it, yet there's no way of me knowing that it benefits me directly. And that has led to things such as the creation of MCX, where a lot of large merchants in the U.S. are trying to bypass the networks.
Matt, do you want to start to answer that? We may have to start now and then continue after break.
Yeah, sure. No problem at all. Let me answer both those great questions pretty quickly. So product-level data, just for those that are listening, basically, if you're at Visa or MasterCard, you know that you've walked into a Walmart and you spend $100 at Walmart. That's useful. But actually, it doesn't tell you that you've spent $20 on some videos, $20 on some beer, $20 on some chips. And that's the kind of data that then helps shape rewards programs more effectively. So the merchants see that and can shape more detail. Although there's a great little business I'd urge people to look at called Itemize that I came across in the States. And it takes receipts data and loads it up onto a platform and allows that type of analysis to take place and to be shared. So have a little look at that. In terms of the bypassing the networks, strategically, it makes a huge amount of sense for retailers to say, I don't need you anymore. And the example of MCX, that's the merchant exchange in the States, which is a mobile wallet program, is a great example of saying, we'll do this together in a collegiate style.
You know, we have to go to break now. David, stay on the phone in case you have a follow-up question.
Thank you.
I should add, David is the head of an organization that I belong to called NYPAY, which is a New York area payment industry networking group that anyone in the payment industry here is welcome to join. Don't go away. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616. The way we do banking today continues to evolve. No longer is it just brick-and-mortar locations or traditional banker's hours. Today, banking is 24/7. It's in the home. It's on the go. It's digital. Tune in to Breaking Banks with Brett King for a look at how traditional banking as we know it has changed due to a loss of trust, changing economic conditions and consumer behavior, government involvement, and, of course, technology. What does it all mean? Listen every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific, on the Voice America Business Channel. From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network. You are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Global Reach. I am here with my guest, Matt Sinister, from Oriyama Consulting Group based in London. And we have a listener, David True, who's the head of NYPAY, the New York Area Payments Networking Group. Matt, you had a question for David.
Yeah, I was just interested with, from David's point of view, what was sort of sitting behind his questions, because they hit the mark right on in terms of some of the challenges that we're seeing, not only in Europe, but probably North America too.
Well, I certainly wanted to just, I figured you would have touched on this eventually, but I wanted to make sure you did because it's of particular interest to me, and especially a perspective from outside of the U.S., since sometimes we here get lost in the U.S. and don't think enough about what's going on in the other areas where plastic payments are widely accepted.
Okay, well, I mean, I'm going to pick up on something you said where we left off was, do you think that retailers or merchants might bypass the payments networks? And the merchant exchange is an example of where that's happening. I think the challenge is that nobody really likes the schemes Visa and MasterCard. It's complex, it appears pricey, and the infrastructure is really well embedded in the global payments network. So it's hard, it's tough, and that's put a lot of people off. But that isn't really a defensible stance from the Visas and MasterCards of the world. Ultimately, technology is going to lower the barriers to doing this. And whilst there's been talk, again, particularly in Europe, of developing a fourth major payments network that's a collegiate network amongst smaller banks and merchants, it hasn't got off the ground because it is a very complex, very long-term investment. And as I opened my introduction tonight, there's not a huge amount of money flying around for these long-term payback initiatives.
Thank you.
Interesting. So let's go further along the line. We're talking about the ability to change customer behavior. And you were saying customer purchase behavior is heavily influenced by rewards. Is that true on both sides of the Atlantic?
It's true globally. Particularly, you see that in the maturer cards markets of the world, which are primarily UK, Western Europe, and the US, where rewards are an embedded part of the consumer psyche around payments. Let me ask you, or certainly pose the question to your listeners. If you walk into a store and somebody says, if you use card A, I'm going to give you 5% cash back, and if you use card B, I'm going to give you nothing. Nobody is going to turn down the use of card A, of course, if it's in their wallet. And that's really where I'm driving in terms of the ability for the retailer to change behavior. In that instant, even if somebody's already decided they want to use a certain type of payment method, their mind can be changed. And again, that can only happen when you have that connection with that customer, and that connection is either face-to-face at the point of sale or indeed online at point of click. So that ability to harness change is really important.
But what happens if my bank card says, I'll give you 2% cash back if you use my card, and my retailer says, I'll give you an extra 30% off the cost if you buy the product with my store card?
It becomes mostly a rational argument. You think, well, 30% off what is likely to be a reasonably large ticket item, typically more than $50 if you're US dollars if you're using a credit card. 30% off that equals more than 2%. So the store card in this instance will always win.
But the store card probably has a 19 or 20% interest rate on it.
Absolutely, and higher in other countries as well. If you look at Latin America, those store cards are well into the 30 and 40% range.
And your bank card might have 8% if you're using a charge.
Yeah, and we've done plenty of studies that say the APR, so that's the rate at which you would repay that loan on a credit card, it is far and away well behind rewards when it comes to deciding which card you're going to use. And that is across any international market.
I'm sorry, say that one more time.
So
the APR is more or less powerful than rewards?
Far less.
Interesting. We've talked a lot about...
The only time APR is important is at the initial acquisition of that card. After that, people don't really look at it.
Interesting.
If I may ask a question?
Go ahead, David.
Do you see any correlation between rewards, what we call in the States rewards junkies, and in other words, do rewards people who are heavily driven by rewards tend to skew towards revolvers or transactors, or is there no particular correlation? And transactors, by transactors for the audience, I mean people who pay their balance off at the end of the month versus those people who would make use of that APR and borrow.
Rewards are universal, so it doesn't matter whether you're borrowing or just using that card to pay the payment, whether that's a debit or a credit card. So that is not influenced by it. Typically, if you're spending a lot more on a card, you're a transactor, i.e. you're using it just to make a payment, and you will ultimately build up rewards more quickly into a bigger pot. But we're touching here on something that I think is often forgotten. So we talk about the power of the retailer in terms of or the shifting power to the retailer in terms of perhaps providing rewards. The other element here that I've also seen is they're also better at fulfilling those rewards.
Mm.
There is nothing worse, and all your listeners, I'm sure, will have an experience of a rewards program when they come to redeem those rewards, but actually the process is bad, the stock may not be available, the blackout dates might come into play if you've got an airline ticket, and the instant that redemption process doesn't match the promise, that's when you'll move to another card or another payment type. And there's very little real effort in the industry to construct seamless reward systems. And those that are doing it better, or redemption systems, and those that are doing it better are ultimately the retailers, because, again, they've been doing it longer, and ultimately it's more important to them to keep that customer happy and coming into store.
We've been talking mostly about point of sale, the in-store experience. But so much of purchases are shifting to e-commerce, purchases over the internet. Is there a difference in the way consumers approach their cards, make their choice of cards, whether they're shopping in-store or online? And then online, where does PayPal come into all of this?
Well, PayPal's a great case study, and I'm glad you raised it. PayPal is perhaps emerging as the dominant merchant or retail force globally in terms of both consumer perception. And also, interesting, I think they just launched their own lending product to businesses as well this week, as well as looking at acceptance. I think that online, there's probably less ability to influence behavior short term. So it's hard to make a pitch to use a particular payment type when somebody's clicking through a website. They've already decided which card they're going to use. But again, I think the data that the retailer will see, which pages you've looked at, where you visited before, all that information that's stored in cookies is really valuable for shaping future offers and building more tailored rewards programs. And that data that they see, and that David mentioned before, is the ace in the hole in terms of that shifting power to the retailer in terms of providing better targeted rewards and benefits to their shoppers.
Well, now that we're online, let's talk about social media. In the U.S., around 85% of online users engage with social media, and I've seen figures in China, Europe, that are up there. Who's got the edge in social media, the banks or the merchants?
That's a good one, and my genuine answer is I'm not sure at this stage, but I'll give you some anecdotal points of view. We've done a little bit of research in terms of social media from banks, and the biggest piece of feedback that we got, and it was very forcefully delivered in this survey, was banks should not treat this channel like a sales channel. Banks, for a long period of time, thought this was a way of actually making some money by connecting with their consumers or potential consumers. And the feedback was very clear, this is social media, not business media. Get out of my life, thank you very much. And anybody that tries to get in there is very, very quickly managed out. The other thing that we've seen that the banks haven't been quite ready for is the immediacy of the feedback that they're getting on certain things, whether it's Twitter or whether it's Facebook. And that can work both ways. It's a great thing. The banks have used that now to embrace customer communication. So when Hurricane Sandy happened approximately a year ago in the east coast of the States, they were very quick to use social media to let people know where ATMs were working and where they weren't, where branches were open and where they weren't. So they've begun to learn how to use social media a little bit more effectively to be a tool of communication, not a tool of sales. The retailers, I don't have as much experience with, but what I do know, again, is they've probably positioned their sales messages more appropriately in terms of the fact they've just got more interesting things to say in terms of their product. People don't want to hear about an investment account, but actually if they're going to get 10% off at the local Walmart store, that's a little bit more relevant to them. So I think it's not necessarily whether banks are doing it better or retailers are doing it better. It's just more interesting the offers you're going to get from retailers.
Well, the other side of it is I wonder how much the consumers are using social media to change bank or brand behavior. As we see all these campaigns.
David,
I'm thinking the latest one being the whole Bangladesh factory campaign that's on, and there's a lot of pressure. It seems to me that it's being responded to more on your side of the pond than ours.
It's the immediacy issue, and I think what we haven't seen, banks historically have been very slow-moving structures. And the ability to react to what is going on within their user community has been pretty slow at a strategic level. Now, within hours, the CEO of some of these banks will actually start getting reports in that something's gone viral and is an issue and has to respond. And that's a bit of an anathema to very rational organizations that are being pushed and pressured into responding really quickly when they're not used to it.
Speaking of banks being slow-moving, and speaking of PayPal, where is the innovation in the industry coming from? Are we seeing innovation from the banks, or are we seeing it from the retailers? We talked about PayPal, but where else?
Where else? Well, let me answer the first question there. Are we seeing it from the
we'll
banks?
Start it, because we're going to go to break and then continue in you.
Yeah, I'll be quick on the first one. Is innovation is not being driven by the banks, and that's very clearly down to the amount of cash they've got to spend on new initiatives. There is far less cash in the banking industry, particularly the retail banking industry, than there was 5 years ago. And just that basic fact meant that there's been a lot of cost control, and actually they've looked at things that give them a much shorter return on investment. And I think everybody can rationalize that. Therefore, by default, anything new that's coming out there that's either mobile-based or payments-based is being driven by other stakeholders that probably have more to gain by taking advantage of the bank's weaknesses at the moment.
I wonder whether we're going to start to see the banks relegated to some kind of accounting companies and placeholders, but we'll talk about that when we get back from break.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business. Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616. Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
Always talking business. Talk to an expert. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Global Reach, winning in world markets. This is your host, Tay Revez, and I am here with my guest, Matt Sinester from Oyama Consulting, and he's calling us from London, where it is 7:30 at night. So we really appreciate it. Matt, we were talking about innovation. We were saying it's really not coming from the banks, PayPal, Square, mobile. So are the banks just a balance sheet to rent in the world of payments?
This is a really good question, one we could spend plenty of time on. But let me try and summarize. So I think historically the banks have always said, well, we're going to build this ourselves. We're really good at this kind of stuff. But actually there's a much bigger choice out there now, which is either build, buy, or outsource. And what we've seen with the explosion of technology genuinely is that application to payments has also exploded because there's money floating around in the system that a lot of these organizations think they can take advantage of. A few years ago, PayPal was very innovative and made it very easy for the consumers. So the point I'm going to make here is the technology has been around with lots of these organizations, and sometimes it's been bank-invented. But the reason the technology agenda is being driven by non-banks is that these non-banks have a much better idea of actually what the value proposition is for the consumer. PayPal and Amazon are great examples of where you get onto the website, you click, and everything is done. There's one click. It's really, really simple. But actually, you go onto a bank's website to try and get through and get things done. It's really quite clunky in comparison. The retail and the merchant community get it in terms of what the value proposition should look like, and particularly in the world of making a payment. And that's why I think we're seeing still a lot of the innovation there. I think the other point you were talking about is what is the role of banks? And there's two things that I want to bring out to your audience. I think, firstly, banks are still incredibly well-run, despite all of the PR in terms of safety, security, fraud controls, all of those things that actually made banks what they were historically. And therefore, yes, they are just a balance sheet, but they are incredibly safe balance sheets and incredibly good in terms of management of other people's money, despite all the PR.
You know, I was at a conference last year that was sponsored by NiPay, an unconference, not a conference, but some of the people there actually took the position that banks were eventually just going to be the accounting unit for the payment transaction and not really be involved anymore.
I think that's a very valid point of view, and I think it is certainly going towards that. But ultimately, we've done some research, and I think some research was also published yesterday by an organization called Consult Hyperion, which matches up with ours that we did in a publication called Carbeat, that said, when it came down to it, who would you much prefer your financial services to be provided by? And we listed well-known supermarkets that have financial products, well-known technology businesses, the Googles and the Amazons of the world, and the banks. If you've got money to put somewhere and you want it to be safe and sound, the banks win. And this was really interesting. So regardless of the WYSI technology or the ultimate value proposition, where do you feel safest ultimately investing your well-earned dollar, yen, or pound? And it was still with the banks. So they still have a huge degree of trust when they boil down to it. Pardon me. People like, I won't just pick on Google, but organizations like Google or Yahoo scored very, very badly in actually managing finances and providing financial tools. They were fine in terms of the shopping experience, clearly, but ultimately the bank's brand still won out, and there's a number of studies that suggest that. So you could certainly see banks being more balance sheet-based and providing services through third parties, but they still have a big role and to play, and they still ultimately are perceived as safe and secure globally, despite some of the things we've seen over the last 5 years.
Well, I'm going to put in a personal commercial for just a second, because we were talking about NiPay, Consult Hyperion, and Google, and October 24th, NiPay and Consult Hyperion are going to have another unconference on the future of transactions. You're welcome to come if you're back in New York. They're going to be at the Google offices in New York. So, and if anybody wants to find out more about it, you can look us up on LinkedIn or www.nipay.org. Let me ask you further a little bit more on the innovation side. The banking industry, you mentioned it, is highly regulated. How do you manage financial product development if you're in this highly regulated environment? How do you build a product that's more consumer-centric so you're not just an accounting unit and your role isn't just being the safeguard of money?
This is the catch-22. To be more innovative, you need to sometimes push the boundaries, and sometimes if it's completely new, you're inventing your own rules because you're ahead of the legislation. That's the catch-22 for banks, whereas what we're seeing with other innovators in Square is they're not regulated in the same way, therefore they can actually look at things from a different way. I think that's always going to be a problem for banks, is the level of regulation. Of course, they're trying to lobby more effectively to ensure that others that are producing the same types of products and services or same channels to market are regulated in the same way. But their political capital globally is pretty low. And you look at the lobbying that we've seen internationally by retailers and merchants, particularly on things like the cost of card acceptance and interchange, they've really been fantastic at that. And there's a lot of great examples.
Now, could you define interchange for those of our audience who are not part of the payments industry?
Sure. Interchange, and trying to make it simple, is when there is a card payment, ultimately there's a fee paid between the bank that has issued that card. So if I've got a Citi card and I use it in a store, there is a payment made by my bank to the bank that accepts that card. And then there's money in the middle that is used to fund that transaction, and the merchant also has to partly fund that transaction. So a merchant typically might have to pay anything between, depending on which market you're in globally, perhaps 0.2% of the transaction fee, up to, in some markets, up to 1.8 or 1.9% of that transaction fee. So if they're selling a $100 item, maybe up to $2 of that income will be sent to the bank as a, I was going to say as a thank you, but not quite the right phrase.
As a fee for doing business, facilitating the transaction.
Exactly. So for making that transaction smooth and efficient.
Clearly that's something that's going to bite into a low-margin retailer like a supermarket or hypermarket, and less so on a high-margin retailer like a Tiffany's.
But it's still a big cost of doing business.
So, but as you say, this has been one of the most signal achievements of the merchant industry around the world. U.S., Australia, and coming in Europe, where the merchants have actually gotten governments to regulate a lowering of those interchange fees. So they've cut the bank's income, and how did they get the government to lower those fees? What was their promise?
Their value proposition
to government?
The value proposition was, this is bad for consumers. It's part of the cost of these products. We have to build it in. Therefore, if you can take out some of those extra fees that we pay by lowering interchange, it means that we can pass this saving on to the consumer by lowering our product costs. So it's been a great promise. If you look at the Australian experience, which happened probably about 5 years ago now, where interchange was regulated, if you speak to the consumer on the corner, certainly prices have not gone down, and ultimately the retailers have retained all of that margin. So instantly they've created perhaps up to 1% on every transaction they've made, every piece of value. So it's been very clever by the retailers and very, very lucrative as well. We've seen that in the United States on debit products, not credit yet, and we're going to be seeing it in Europe, where it's going to be regulated down pretty heavily in some markets. What I would say globally is this trend is very consistent, and interchange will be dropping across all markets ultimately over a period of time, whether that's 5 or 10 years. I'm convinced of that. And going back to our retailer versus bank, what that means is there's even less money for the bank to play with in terms of funding these rewards programs to get them to choose their products. And there's even more money for the merchants to actually, if they want to reinvest in loyalty. So it's making that gap between the attractiveness of a bank or a retailer even bigger than it was today.
So I've got an email question from a listener that's very relevant to this. This is coming from Roy Stevenson of Strategic Planning and Marketing, and he's also based in the UK. So he says, payment card profitability is sinking like a stone. So how can banks build sufficient value into the product to pursue the customers to pay for their cards and clearly to restore their income?
Well, firstly, he's spot on. And the UK happens to be first, but or the most current. We saw it in Australia, but it will be happening in other markets where profitability of your card issuer, is falling. There's no doubt about that for all kinds of features. So, great question. What do you do next? And I think the hypothesis we're seeing in a lot of these is actually twofold. If you want to keep the same level of rewards and product value, you're going to have to pay for that, and you're probably going to have to pay a fee in some shape or form. Now, actually, we've done some research that suggests consumers don't mind paying a fee as long as they can see the exchange of value. The other thing I think we'll see is a lot more product simplicity. And going back, if I use the example of credit cards, where actually credit cards started off as a very simple product, will effectively give you a line of credit. You can get 56 days interest-free. The APRs are really low. Just pay us back on time. Well, I think we'll start to see really simple products where there aren't any rewards programs, where actually they just become facilities, easy payment facilities. And maybe there's going to be some messing around on the length of time your interest-free period is. And I think we might see the rise of charge cards a little bit more, that as this quasi-product that they allow you to borrow for a month and then pay off in full. Mm. And that's an interesting space, because charge cards appeal not only to the affluent, like we see with the Amex products, for example, but research also suggests that they appeal an awful lot to the near-prime audience, or those that struggle with their day-to-day spending, because they're perceived as a tool to manage finances more effectively. So we might see charge cards rise as part of the mix. But ultimately, we're going to see a gap between richly funded rewards programs, probably by a fee, or very simplistic products that don't provide much value apart from a facility.
Well, I had a follow-up question. Some of the argument in Europe, at least that the retailers are making, is that the value of a payment card is fairly low to them. So if that's the case, Roy's question is, why don't they stop accepting cards and take only cash or checks?
Can you imagine the banks deciding tomorrow in Europe to say, well, actually, if they're not important to you, we're not going to process any of your transactions? Now, I think they'll suddenly find that cards are so embedded in the payments infrastructure that actually retailers will go out of business if cards weren't, transactions weren't processed, even for a couple of days. So actually, I think that's a very misleading statement by retailers in terms of the functionality of cards. Cards are really popular with consumers, and they have been for 40 years. They're not going to go away in any near time. I think the argument is better placed around cash, in terms of, actually, are there more convenient ways to pay for small ticket items that aren't cash based? And that's where mobile and contactless cards really do come in. But payment cards are here to stay, and I think that's probably a misleading message by the retail community.
And if I may raise a point there.
Oh, David, you're still here.
Yeah, I'm sorry. This is a great conversation. I don't think the merchants really... What the merchants are noting is that the cost of accepting payments have gone up with time rather than down. And as volume increased, economics would tell you that the cost of processing transactions should drop. And I think that's where the resistance comes from, rather than the fact that they think the consumers want to pay with plastic. Clear.
David, is there a question there?
No, it's really more, I mean, do you agree with that, actually? Does that point make sense to you? Because I don't see the merchants as making a threat. Do you think they are?
There's always a threat. I mean, merchants are probably the most aggressive negotiators out there in all the segments around the world. They're hardcore when it comes to negotiating and getting their point of view across. So I think that there are threats out there, but I think there's certainly more smoke than fire. They just don't like paying fees, but I'm afraid they're going to have to put up and shut up, because if they didn't accept cards, they'd go out of business. And I think the more enlightened retailers would probably say that to you one-to-one if you caught them in a side conversation.
And when we say cards, we also are saying mobile phones, et cetera, the whole panoply of payment devices.
Yep.
I want to go back to something you said about the banks, that they're the place that it's safe to keep your money. So to some extent, there's a lot of trust in the bank brand, or at least in certain bank brands. And some banks may score highly on customer service, but overall, consistently, their brand strength, I think, is lower than the large retailers. Why?
There's a huge amount of trust with retailers. So without getting too philosophical, a retailer, let's say your local supermarket, is a great example. You go in there once, twice, three times a week. You buy your food, your groceries. It's an everyday spend. There's an emotional attachment to it. They keep you clothed and fed. And therefore, ultimately, you do end up trusting them more. They give you more back in rewards. You come back in. You build that emotional attachment. Banks are very rational and don't treat you in quite the same way. And you only interact irregularly with the bank directly, and even more so now that with internet banking and IVRs, phone systems. So retailers are just trusted more implicitly. And again, we've done some work that suggests when you've looked at retail credit cards versus bank credit cards, everybody loves it. And this is a UK example, by the way. People love Virgin credit cards. Most people have heard of Virgin. People love Tesco credit cards, which is the UK's largest supermarket chain. Absolutely adore them, much, much more than the banks. When you ask them, who do you want to look after your money, the banks just still score highly. So I think that there's an emotional attachment that builds brand reputation and trust, and there's a rational attachment to actually, I want to keep my money safely. Here's a really good story about how important that brand trust is in the world of payments, and I can't be name names here, but there is a bank that has a co-branded credit card that is a high street retailer credit card. We asked those bank's customers to rate the customer service they got on that high street bank credit card, and it was fantastic. We then asked them, another segment of customers, to ask what they thought of their customer service was directly from this bank's card. And they thought, oh, it's very average. They were exactly the same customer service standards with that product. Exactly the same. They went to the same call center, the same operators picked up the phone. Yet they just felt they wanted to more comfortable with that retail brand. Another great example is PayPal. You look at the trust that PayPal instills. Everybody implicitly trusts them, but actually they cost far, far more to process payments than the banks.
And
if you're a little merchant out there and you used a MasterCard or a Visa-type solution, you might pay, let's say, 1.5% of that interchange that we talked about earlier. If you're doing it through PayPal, you're paying 3.5%.
Wow.
People love them. So that brand really attracts a premium to some of these things. And that's, again, this is the power that the retailers can do by giving you an emotional attachment to a brand.
So there's a question that you posed when we were talking. No banks have become successful retailers, but many retailers have become successful providers of financial products. Why?
I think the banks haven't got much to sell. I mean, a retailer can sell anything they want. I don't mean to be flippant. So it's very hard for them to break into. Where retailers are great is they've used banks in the past, and they've had perhaps joint ventures, and they've learned. And actually then they've decided, we can do this better ourselves. We're much more customer-focused than you ever will be. And again, we can afford to invest more in it because actually we by increasing our sales spend, is going to be far more than we'll ever make on financial products. So I think ultimately, the retailers can do it more effectively themselves, and they've used the banks as a Trojan horse to get into financial services. And also, the regulatory regime around the world has made it easier for a lot of organizations to actually enter financial services.
When you say that retailers are providing financial services, are you saying beyond their store cards? Beyond the...
Yes, absolutely.
Give us some examples, because I know Walmart's tried it, but really actually wasn't successful. They're now in a deal with American Express. It looks like it's becoming more successful, but their original efforts, particularly their original prepaid card, which basically they took all the customers' money in fees, kind of flopped badly. So what are some examples of successful merchant entries?
My reference points, I'm afraid, are UK-based rather than internationally at the moment.
That's fine.
But
from where I sit, UK is international.
Thank you. There are three examples. For example, Tesco's, the UK's biggest retailer, has launched its own bank, and it is launching. It started with cards. Cards are often the focal point. But it is branching out into mortgages, savings, which is what we've had for a while, and current accounts. Marks and Spencer's, which is probably the UK's premium retailer, is doing exactly the same. Launched with cards, now going into banking. John Lewis, which is perhaps the mass premium retailer in the UK and the best reputation of any retailer in the UK, started with a card program, is now going to be launching current accounts. Virgin started with a card program with Bank of America, has bought that back, and is now launching a current account and has had a mortgage or checking account, I should say, and has had a mortgage product. So in the UK, for example, the retailers are exploding in terms of their depth to get into financial services. And that's not necessarily to make pure margin from financial services products, but by capturing more of that consumer spend, going back to one of our earlier points, more data about that consumer's behaviors, they think they can help their core retail business even more effectively.
Wow.
And I think that trend is going to happen, I think, in other markets. But I'm just not as familiar with Asia, for example, to know whether that's already been the case.
I think that's absolutely fascinating. You know, we have come to the end of our time. So how do our listeners get in touch with you if they want to follow up with you?
If you're happy, I can just quickly read out my email address.
Please do.
Any questions, I'll always follow up. Always try and follow up by phone call as well if you want to do that. It's matt.semester, S-I-M for mother, E-S-T-E-R, at acg.net. And our website is acg.net as well. So we look forward to getting any of your questions and queries.
And your bio is up on the voiceamerica.com website, and we did put the RAMA URL in your bio, so you can be
great
found
stuff
there. I want to thank you so much. I think this is a fascinating discussion. David, thanks for joining in. Please come to the unconference on the future of transactions on the 24th. And next week, we've got a really interesting show. We're going to be joined by shareholder advocate and veteran of the Bush 1 administration, Robert Monks. He's the author of a really disturbing book called Citizens Disunited, Passive Investors, Drone CEOs, and the Corporate Capture of the American Dream. This is part of our Arrogance of Institution series. He's going to be joined by Charlie Kolb, who's the head of the French-American Foundation, and Bruce Fried, who's the head of the Center for Political Accountability, which is a shareholder responsibility center and a shareholder resolution center. So I hope you will all join us. We've done Citizens United. Now we're going to talk about Citizens Disunited. It's going to be a fascinating show. We'll be doing more payment shows in the future. Matt, again, thank you so much for joining in.
No problem.
I really appreciate it, and I know our listeners do. And on behalf of Matt and myself, we wish you great success in the coming week in extending your global reach.
Thank you for listening to Global Reach with Tay Revez. Please join us again next Thursday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Have a great week.